Welcome to Bill Bronchick's Real Estate Investing Podcast. Mr. Bronchick is an attorney, best-selling author, and a real estate investor with 25 years' experience. For more information and free articles and videos, visit his website at www.legalwiz.com.
All right, welcome everyone to the weekly call. Bill Bronchick with you. We're going to talk about this week first how to do comps on property. Seems to be something that everybody, even beginner or intermediate or advanced, could use a little brush up on. And physically how to do the comps, you know, where to do them and so forth and what websites. Comps, so they're called comparable sales, are one of the three ways to evaluate a property. There's three acceptable methods. There's the comparable sales method, there's the income approach, and there's the replacement value. Replacement value is something that you use for insurance purposes, and it has little bearing on the real value. And then you have other things like assessed value, which is, you know, could be more or less, generally is a little bit less than the market value. That's what the county assesses it at. But it's not a bad place to look, especially when you're comparing properties, like, you know, trying to figure out the lot value of being against the golf course or the beach versus across the street. You could see the lot value difference on the tax assessor website. But what we're going to talk about is focusing on those comparable sales. Single family, duplex, triplex, fourplex. So 1 to 4 family residential uses the comparable sales method. 5 family residential and up is not considered residential anymore. It's considered commercial. And you use the income approach, which is going to focus on things like cap rates and net operating income and so forth. If we have a little time towards the end, I'll go into that a little bit. Now, comparable sales. First of all, what is comparable? Well, Appraisal School 101 says we're going to look at properties that are relevant to the subject property within a mile as the crow flies and that were sold within the last 6 months. Now, let's talk about both of those. Up to a mile is a long way. In a rural area, yes. In a suburban or urban neighborhood, that's way too far. We'd start with stuff that's on the block, if not on the block, within the subdivision. If not within the subdivision, we can't find anything, then we're going to go to the next closest subdivision that is similar prices, similar age, similar, you know, types of build. In terms of comparison, think of it this way. It's more of an art than a science. It's like going to get a TV at Best Buy. So you go to Best Buy and you got TVs, you know, all the way from 300 up to 1,000. And so you look at this, the bottom one, which is some Korean brand you never heard of, like Daewoo, and you throw that one out. And then you go to take out the Sony because that's probably $1,000, you know, really high-end brand, throw that one out. And then in the middle, between $400 and $600, you got your sweet spot. You got your Samsungs, your Panasonics, your other similar brands that are well-known, Toshiba, so forth. And you're going to compare size of screen. You're going to compare features. You're going to compare resolution. You're going to compare, the audio features and so forth. And then you'll get to a sweet spot where you're going to narrow it down to 2 or 3 about the same price. And that's really the same method that we do for comparable sales. We're trying to find stuff that is closely comparable. So now what is comparable? Well, first let's start with size. If a house that you're looking at has sold is within 25%, maybe even a little more, maybe even 35% of the square footage of the subject property, it's comparable in size. But more importantly than size, because a lot of people will take size times square foot, so 1,200 square feet times $100 a foot and come up with 120, that's not entirely accurate. What you're looking to compare is bedrooms and baths to bedrooms and baths. So, for example, a 3-bedroom, 1-bath compares to a 3-bedroom, 2-bath because you can add or subtract for the extra bathroom. A 3-bedroom to a 4-bedroom is comparable. A 2-bedroom to a 3-bedroom or a 2-bedroom to a 4-bedroom are generally not comparable. There's a big jump in value between a 2-bedroom house and a 3, less so between a 3 and a 4 or a 5. Okay, so the biggest jump in value is, you know, from a 2-bedroom to a 3-bedroom, which, by the way, you should look for opportunities. If you find a 2-bedroom that's big, like 1,400 square feet or 1,500 square feet, look at the possibility of chopping off some space somewhere to make a third bedroom and really improve the value of it. So we're looking at stuff that's similar in bedrooms and baths, similar in size, plus or minus 25 to 35% square footage. We're going to look at, and by the way, when I say bedrooms, bedrooms have to be conforming, meaning if you have a ranch with a basement with those little windows, those two bedrooms in the basement can't be counted. Okay, so when you're comparing, you should compare main floor or upstairs bedrooms to main floor upstairs bedrooms. You theoretically could compare a bedroom in a basement that has a full egress window or a walkout as a bedroom to compare it with something else, but it's going to be obviously worth a little less to have a bedroom in a basement versus a bedroom on a main floor. One exception to that would be a very hot area like a Phoenix, where you have a walkout basement and you can have potentially a master bedroom on the lower floor because it's cooler. But generally speaking, garden level bedrooms are going to be worth less than main floor or up second floor bedrooms. Okay. Then we have to look at style of house. There's all different types of styles of houses. You got your ranch, you got your cape, you have a split ranch, you have a bi-level, you have a tri-level, you have the colonial two-story with the bedrooms upstairs. And in different climates and different areas, you'd have different types of, you know, bungalows and, you know, all different types of, but generally speaking, in most markets, the two-story colonial with the, you know, main floor, basement or not, and plus bedrooms upstairs is going to be your highest value in terms of style in the neighborhood. Whereas a ranch is somewhere in the middle to upper, depending on the climate. Like if you're in Florida, hot climate, you want a ranch. You don't want a two-story house unless it's brand new and has really good ventilation. But generally speaking, the colonials are the higher end of the neighborhood, and then the split levels, capes, and bi-levels and tri-levels are on the lower end of the neighborhood. So you got to make sure you're comparing apples to apples because, for example, a three-bedroom, two-bath ranch compared to a three-bedroom, two-bath colonial with bedrooms upstairs and then everything else on the main floor is not – there's going to be a big difference in value there. So you have to adjust for that. Age is also a factor you have to look at. There's pre-50s, there's post-50s, 70s, and then 90s and newer. So a house built pre-50 is not always comparable with something like built in the 70s or 90s unless the old house was completely renovated up to date, you know, new electrical, new plumbing, and so forth. So you got to make sure you're comparing, you know, the appropriate age, style, bedrooms, bathrooms, square footage, and location. Now, then we get into the little subtleties. Which is more important, location to the subject property or is it age of the comp? So, for example, if you are looking at a condo, a two-bedroom condo, condos are very unique per development. It's hard to compare one development with another unless they were built by the same developer around the same time. So, for example, if I have a two-bedroom condo I'm trying to comp, and across the hall, the same two-bedroom condo sold a year ago for X price, technically that's older than 6 months and we wouldn't count it. So we'd have to go down the road to a different development for one that sold last month. But logically, that doesn't make sense because the one across the hall is the most like yours. And even though it was a year ago, you could probably extrapolate that the market in this area has gone up 8% and just mark it up 8%. An appraiser won't do that, but I think we can do that as investors to get a ballpark value. Okay. The last thing I'll tell you is an appraisal looks at comparable sales in the past, you know, the last 6 months. you have to adjust seasonally. So if you're looking at stuff, it is now April, and you're looking at a sale in December, obviously that's going to be a lower number than something that you bought now, put on the market in July after you fixed it up, not just because it's a, you know, year over year, it might be an increase in value because of the market, but just because of the seasons, the adjustment for the seasons, it's going to lag behind. So what you also want to do is look at properties that are currently for sale in the same neighborhood and extrapolate a little bit of, okay, this is what's happened in the last 6 months, this is what's happening now. Is it higher, the same, or lower than what happened 3 months ago? I mean, ideally, you'd use comps of properties that are currently under contract, ready to close. That's the most freshest comp, okay, as opposed to something that's sold a couple of months ago. Finally, you want to make sure that the comparable sales were clean sales. What I mean is between a seller, a perfectly nice house, you know, all updated, paint, carpet, everything, that was sold to a buyer who got a bank loan, used a realtor, and then lives in it as his primary residence. You don't want to use comps from short sales, foreclosure sales, you know, maybe a sale between investors of a junker property. Those are not going to be accurate. You want to look at sales that were clean, what I call clean sales. You know, it's going to be something that you're going to be doing in the case of a fix and flip, where it would be beautiful and it would be on the multiple listing and represented by a real estate broker, and they got a FHA or Fannie Mae loan. Okay, so make sure you take that into account. Okay, so where are we going to find this stuff? Well, ideally, you'd have a good real estate broker or agent who could pull it off the multiple listing for you, especially under contract stuff, which is very hard to find on consumer websites. So they could pull what's for sale, what is sold, and what's currently under contract. They could pull market data. They could pull all kinds of stats. The only challenge with that is if that realtor is also the listing realtor and telling you this is a good deal, how do you know you're getting the not getting skewed information that they cherry-picked for you because they want to sell you the house? So just keep that in mind. If it's your realtor, the one that you hired to represent you, then it's accurate, probably. In addition to that, or if you don't have access to that, there are three main websites that you can use to get comparable sales data, market data, and properties for sale, and those are Zillow, Redfin, R-E-D-F-I-N, and Trulia, T-R-U-L-I-A. They all present it a little differently, but they give you the comp data. They show it on a map, how close it is. They show pictures. Usually most of the information of the sale was pulled from the MLS, so it should be identical. So, for example, if you're trying to figure out if something was a, quote, clean sale, the listing information, the pictures, and the realtor notes should be in those websites. So, for example, if it says brand new countertops slab granite, stainless steel appliances, totally gutted, you know, from A to Z, then that's a clean sale. If it says recently refreshed, that just means a carpet, you know, a carpet cleaning and a coat of paint. You know, that may not be a real upgrade, because if it had slab granite countertops and stainless steel appliances and all new flooring, it would say that in the ad. If it doesn't say that, you can assume that it's not there. So you may want to adjust that comparable if it doesn't say all those things in it. All three websites have what are called computer automated valuation models, or AVMs. Zillow has what's called a Zestimate. Those are sometimes right on the money and often way off. If you have no clue and you're looking for a starting point, like you're on the phone with a seller and they go, here's the address of my house, I'm asking $200, and you can go on Zillow and Zillow says $200, well, you're pretty close, probably. If Zillow says $400, you should jump up and down. But if Zillow says $150, I would do more research, but I wouldn't get that excited. But you want to get it much more accurate than that. Generally speaking, in neighborhoods where everything is fairly homogeneous, like something built in the 70s or 80s, where all the houses are built the same time period, they're all similar in style, there's three different styles, Zillow tends to be fairly accurate, and so do the other AVMs. But if you're in a neighborhood where you've got stuff from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and some brand new builds, it's going to be all over the map. So I take that with a grain of salt. I would look at the raw data, the properties that have sold, the properties that are currently for sale, and extrapolate according to the formula I just laid out for you. And most importantly, get off your backside, get out of your chair in your home or office, and drive. You there's things that you can't see on a computer. So, for example, if there's a wonderful view or an obstructed view or a power line or the neighbor has five barking Rottweilers jumping up and down on the fence when you go look at the subject property, that's going to affect its value. Or your neighbor's just a slob and, you know, it could affect the value of your house. If there's a HUD property for sale next door and on the other side and another one across the street, that's going to affect your ability to resell the house. So you can't do those things on the computer. You have to print out the information and literally drive the comps. And you'll see sometimes, I get it. This one's a corner lot. That's why this one sold for more. Or, this one's under a power line. That's why it sold for less. Or if you can't figure it out, knock on the door. Most people will answer, and you could say, listen, I hate to bother you, but I have a house down the block. I'm getting ready to sell, and I'm trying to figure out what it's worth. You know, according to public records, you bought this for $250. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions about it? Like, you know, was it fixed up when you bought it, or did you do work? Did you use a regular loan, or did the seller carry terms which might affect the sale price, and so forth? Most people will give you the information, you know, just for asking. Just be nice, knock on the door, and do it during the day. And remember, again, it's not an exact science, but we want to get the after repaired value, what it's worth after it's fixed up, as close as we possibly can to accurate, within 2-3%. If you're off by 10%, on a fix and flip, we're working on 10% margins. So there goes your profit out the window if you're wrong. Just be conservative if you're not sure. And, you know, worst comes to worst, you can always look for a realtor sign in the neighborhood. If you see the same realtor over and over, that means that's their target neighborhood that they know probably, and call them up and say, hey, I'm putting a house on the market. I'm interviewing some realtors. What do you think I can get for this? Hopefully that's the correct answer. A lot of times realtors will puff a little bit about what they think they can get for you. So you may want to, you know, adjust for what I call the air or BS factor, or as they call it in legal terms, the puffery. And that's basically it. I mean, you could get an appraisal as is and then tell them you're going to do the following work and what would it be worth afterwards. But that's just an opinion. And the thing I don't like about appraisals is they only look backwards. They don't look at what's currently on the market for sale. And if you're going to be doing a rental, then the appraisal's fine. But if you're doing a fix and flip, what's for sale now? What's just coming to market and what is it priced? Is it higher or lower than the comps in the last 6 months? What you may want to do is pull. There's a form called a broker's price opinion, BPO. You could Google it. It's I believe it's a Fannie Mae form, a standard Fannie Freddie form that you can Google to say BPO sample form, and you'll see the criteria they use to come up with a broker's price opinion. Now, a broker's price opinion, like I just suggested, looks at properties both for sale and sold in the past, whereas an appraisal only looks at what's sold in the past. If you gave the same form, an appraisal form and a BPO, to the same individual, the BPO, I think, would give you a more accurate reading. But some will argue that a realtor is not as good as an appraiser, and therefore the appraisal is more valuable. Could be accurate to say that, but I would look at both. All available information you want to get. Okay? And a last thing, too, just when you're comparing, especially a house in one subdivision versus one maybe across the street, across a main road, make sure they're in the same school district, because that could really change it. Okay. Any questions on doing comps?
Hey, Bill. If I was just going to use a broker for, I was thinking, I've got a broker who's a friend, and I was thinking of just sort of having him standing by for whenever I want comps, just for him
sure.
to run comps, and I could just pay him.
What would you
recommend offering to pay to run comps? I mean, how big of a job is it? Is it $100?
It's not a big job. Most of the MLS systems are pretty simple and pretty sophisticated. You put in an address, you check a couple of boxes, and it spits you out a couple of good reports. If it's a realtor you're going to use from time to time, they should do it for nothing. But if you called the realtor off the street, you know, they may not want to do it.
I was just saying, I've got a friend who's a realtor. I may not be using him for representing me in deals.
Send him a gift card to a nice restaurant. Send him a $100 gift card to a nice restaurant. That'll get
okay,
attention.
Okay, thanks.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah, 1 second before I answer the next question. If you have a realtor friend that you trust or someone you've done business with a lot that you trust that is a specialist in that neighborhood, I would take their word as gold, unless they're the listing agent. You know, because you never know if you're going to get a cherry-picked answer. But if you trust the realtor and that you've worked with them and they are a specialist in that subdivision or neighborhood, I would trust their view of what it should sell for. Go ahead. There was a question.
Yeah, Bill, this is Renee up in Boulder. Mm-hmm. So mostly I've done listings and selling up here in Boulder Valley, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I recently got a listing in Westminster.
Right.
And I've been running comps, you know, to try to find the correct selling price or the correct list price anyway. And what I've noticed about the MLS and the comps in the area, there's mm-hmm. a discrepancy in the way that the they treat square footage
mm-hmm.
as opposed to Boulder. And, of course, Boulder's always weird. But
right.
what I've noticed on the real list, the public records, you know, they call this fair finished value
right.
or fair finished square foot. And so the property is a multi-level in that there's four levels. It's split,
mm-hmm.
split level. And what I've noticed is that when they're listing the square footage, they're only listing the square footage of what's finished and not the basement.
Right. That's correct. Some MLS systems do raw square footage, finished square footage. You want to break that down. Finished square footage versus unfinished is, you know, whatever it costs per square foot to finish. That's the difference, right? So let's say you had, and this goes into basements. So if you have houses with basements in your area, basement square footage, raw, unfinished, is usually worth about 30 to 35% of the main floor if it's not a walkout. Right, if it's just a regular garden level, you know, run-of-the-mill 1950s ranch with a basement. So you got 1,000 square foot on the main level. And let's say that 1,000 square foot is priced at $100,000, okay? And then you have the same house, but now you have 1,000 square foot bed basement below it, unfinished, okay? That's going to give you about $30,000 to $35,000 extra value. Does that make sense? If you finished that basement, you'd probably get, you know, 20 to 30 a foot more.
Right, I understand. Okay.
Right. Now, hold on. One thing. If you make bedrooms in the basement with egress windows, then the bedrooms are counted as bedrooms for comparison, and the non-bedroom finished square foot is just that formula I just described. Does that make sense? So the bottom line is you want to make sure, A, you're comparing apples to apples. So if you're looking at the subject property and they're defining it as, you know, raw versus finished square foot, just make sure the comps are you're doing the same formula. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, it does. So I was I guess maybe kind of it's a word of caution on for people to really dig in and take a look at what the square footage means and what you advertise
yes.
at. And I guess
exactly.
that's why we have a square footage disclosure sheet.
That's why you want to separate out main and second floor and third floor square footage from basement, garden level basement square footage, because it comps at a different price per square foot.
Well, and it's going to be different on, you know, I looked at Zillow and Redfin and
right.
the public records and
right.
and they're all different. And
right.
they're all
usually Redfin and Trulia and all those pull square footage from county tax records, which could be inaccurate. You know, especially if there was an addition done at some point, or let's say it was a two-bedroom house with a one-car attached garage and someone busted in the wall and made it a three-bedroom. Right? That would increase the square footage that may not show on county's records. So just a word of caution, good point. Make sure that you're getting accurate information and you're comparing apples to apples.
Is it so unkosher for me to advertise at the total square footage with the with clear, you know, disclosure about here's how we calculated square footage.
Yeah, as long as you spell out how you calculated it, there's nothing dishonest about saying, you know, total square foot 4,000, main floor, second floor, basement, unfinished, you know what I mean, and you lay it out.
Right, because the convention here in Boulder is to, you know, list every single, you know, square
right.
inch you can possibly
yeah.
report.
And that's also rules from Board of Realtor to Board of Realtor, too. But just make
okay.
sure if you're the consumer doing this data information off of, like, Zillow or Redfin or Trulia, you just find out where that data is being pulled from. Is it being pulled from county tax records, or is it being pulled from the MLS listing? And make sure you – and that's why I said there's no substitute for going and driving. You know, you can only go so far on the computer. You got to look at the thing, bring an electronic tape measure with you, and say, gee, you know, this doesn't match up with the numbers. And just do your own square footage with an electronic tape measure.
Right. You know, the other thing – I mean, just for other people who may or may not be working with a realtor, but if they're pulling comps on the other – on other properties – a lot of times on the MLS, they'll have the a little tab where they can pull some of the disclosure documents, and you can find not only the property disclosure but the square footage disclosure sheet.
Right, right. Yeah. That's good. That, if that information is available, more information is always better. Okay. Good question. Anybody else have a question on comps? Damn, am I that good?
Hey, Bill, this is Dan from Indiana. I've got one,
hey,
and
Dan,
I'm not
how
sure.
Hey, Dan, how are you?
Doing very good, sir. Thank you. I just wanted to check. In our area, our comps, it seems to be a little bit different. I wasn't sure if it's this way everywhere. When we
okay,
do comps
ahead.
In our – I'm sorry?
Go ahead. How does it work in Indiana?
As far as we have a lot of land.
Right.
And what I found in Indiana is – when I look at a comp, it could be they don't want to comp the house for more than an acre of land, and it might have 10 acres. And so we find huge discrepancies because you'll look
right.
at a piece of property, and they're not giving you the right amount of money for the land because the mortgage companies, a lot of times, they don't want to put the money in on the land. They want to put it on the primary dwelling with
mm-hmm.
1 acre or less. And
that's a great point you brought up, Dan, which is lot size to lot size. In most neighborhoods, you know, a quarter acre versus a third of an acre is not going to be tremendously different in value, unless the land has such a premium, like it's just located in a neighborhood that's so premium, and you get a big backyard versus no backyard. Of course, it's going to have some value.
Yeah.
But sometimes, for example, if you're in a low-end neighborhood where the houses are worth like $100,000, I know that's outside of Denver, but that's probably Indiana.
Yeah.
But if you have a second lot, like let's say you have a lot with a house, and then it comes comes with a second lot. What is that lot worth anything? Not much, because to build a second house on that lot is more expensive than the used house is worth.
Absolutely.
So it's not really it's not practically buildable. But if you're talking about an acre and a half versus, you know, a third of an acre, depends on the neighborhood. You know, that could be a difference. I agree. So that's why it's what's nice on the tax assessor websites, they usually break it down between structure and lot value.
Okay,
I don't know if they
great.
Do it in your area, but they do in NARS. So that way you could see, like, well, across the street, which is on the water, that lot value might be three times the lot value of the one across the street. So you got to figure in that premium of lot when you calculate your value of your house.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bill.
Yeah. And also, you got to consider the highest and best use of the property. It may be worth more as a scrape, and if you're just buying a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. That's a great point you raised. Thank you for bringing that up. Also, you know, if you're going to look at tax assessed value, look on the county and look at their formula, how they calculate it. Sometimes in some places, like in Texas, for example, market value, the tax assessed value is supposed to be market value. It's not always, but it's supposed to be. So in that case, it would be pretty close in most cases. Whereas, like in Colorado, they have a formula. Most places they do it at about 85-90%. I don't remember the exact formula, but it's definitely lower in most cases than market. Although when the market was tanking, it was in some cases higher, and it hadn't caught up yet.
Okay.
So that's why tax assessed value it's a starting point, just like Zillow estimate, that's a starting point.
Just another comment.
One more thing, Renee. Just on that, those estimates like tax assessed value and Zillow values, if you're on the phone with someone and you just don't know the neighborhood at all, that's a starting point, just for a discussion. You know what I mean? Because you're not going to have time to do comps and run out in the middle of a conversation. But it's just a good screening thing. If someone says, well, I think my house is worth $920,000, and you look at the Zillow thing and it says $400,000, you're going, wait a minute, something's way off here. You know. Yeah, go ahead, Renee.
Okay, well, it was just an observation and a suggestion. So the house that I'm listing in Westminster, I also manage. Property management. And so I got onto Zillow and looking at this estimate and noticed their square footage is wrong. You know, there was incorrect data. So as the property manager or an association with the manager, I was able to get in and change the data.
Right. You can do that on Zillow. And the reason that's important is because if you're listing it for $300 and a potential buyer looks at it and says, well, Zillow says it's only worth $200.
Exactly.
So you're bolstering. You're basically bolstering your argument in case some knucklehead thinks that's important. So
which
if
brings
you're going to sell a house and the Zillow value is low, you want to get in there and correct it.
Right, which does bring up that there are other knuckleheads that maybe not really associated with the property, like a property manager would be.
Right.
The knuckleheads can get in there and manipulate the numbers.
Yeah. Well, that's as long as they do it on the high side, I don't complain.
Right, they usually do, right?
Right. I did that on my own property. I noticed that the county had it as unfinished basement, and I spent almost $100,000 finishing out my basement. So I put it in there, and it went up because I put two extra bedrooms with egress windows. So I they had it as a 4, and I said no, it's a 6, and the Zillow value went up. Okay. Any questions on the comparable sales methodology or what to comp and what things, or just any other websites that you've used that you might want to suggest to people? And by the way, there are a couple of apps you can buy for your smartphone or your iPad or whatever that will GPS you. So you're standing in front of the house, and then you just click the button, and it knows you're in front of 261 Main Street, and it just shoots you a value right off the spot as you're driving by and looking at a vacant house. That could be very effective. I mean, again, it's more like a Zillow's estimate, but hey, you know, if it gives you some instant data that it pulls from the county that's reasonably accurate, or at least a ballpark, it might be valuable.
Bill, can you name a couple of those apps?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
I can do it, Bill.
Phone. Yeah, what's the one for your phone?
Well, there's Home Snap, and it's got two P's.
Yes, that's the one, Home Snap.
And then the other one, too, is just Realtor.com. I mean, what's nice about that is you can actually go on your tablet and trace out the area that you're going to go to. And once you're in it, all of the MLS listings populate, and then you can put your finger on them, and it gives you the listing price and all that other stuff. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice. Realtor.com has some special stuff that other websites don't have.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, this is Eric Hebel here. You can also use your local title company as a resource. I know Heritage Title has a value finder program that you can do, and you can do some kind of a comparing thing.
Mm-hmm. There are some AVM models that you can pay for. There's a handful of services if you Google them from some of the big title companies and other data companies like DataQuick. They charge about $15 and they give you a real good report, you know, explaining why they came up with this value. And they tend to be a little more accurate than Zillow and the free ones, but they're still automated valuation models, and they don't take into account the barking dog scenario, the high wire above your head, you know, backing up to living in Greeley and smelling the manure or a chicken factory where I was, I don't remember where I was once, and I smelled, you know, chickens. I think it was Longmont. Catch a whiff of that. Can't do that on Zillow. But yeah, like,
seems
first
like bottom line is that,
yeah, go ahead.
It seems like bottom line is you should definitely pick 3 to 5 different sources and compare your information and see where there's discrepancies and try to find out if one system is missing something versus another. And then, you know, if you kind of write them all down, you should be able to go through a list of sources in 30 minutes or less.
It's like getting a realtor opinion. You're going to get 5 different opinions from 5 different realtors, and you ask why. Well, this guy said this. What do you think of that? Well, that guy's an idiot. Here's why. Or I didn't know that, you know, or you know what I mean? So you're just getting different. It's all opinions. So if you get different opinions, it helps you clarify, you know, the data. And again, I will not overstress enough, the importance of getting out of your chair and driving the comps and physically putting your eyeballs on them. Okay. If there are no more questions on that, we will roll to general discussion or deals you want to talk about. Who's got a really dumb question? We give out awards for these things, so you might as well just do it.
I do. I have a question about being audacious in this market.
Uh-huh.
Right now.
You mean pricing it ridiculously high?
I don't like to do the ridiculously high, like, you know, the barf bag high, but high enough where you kind of go, kind of high.
I don't tend to like to do that because the house that I'm selling, I don't like it to be the most expensive in the neighborhood. I try to make it the best value for the money. And then price it accordingly, and, you know, get offers. In a market like we're in now, in Denver especially, where it's so ridiculously hot and there's so few homes for sale, you can push the envelope a hair, but you better have a good reason for it, you know, meaning the finishes are nicer or the addition you put on or the spectacular view, because otherwise the downside, the other side of the coin is price it too high to begin with, then you end up dropping it, and it becomes stale. And people go, oh, yeah, that house. That's been for sale for a month, two, three.
Right. Well, this house is not particular.
There's a tendency to be greedy, you know, where, like, I just put a house up a couple of weeks ago. It was just a run-of-the-mill carpet and paint rehab job, another big job, average neighborhood, and I got 8 offers in the first day. And I took one with 2 backups over the asking price. So part of me goes, oh, man, I should have asked for more, but, you know. When's enough?
Well, I've got, you know, I would say my owner is a bit on the greedy side, which they normally are.
I agree.
Right, and I understand that. And in my experience, they rarely understand that it's not what you think it value is. It's what the public thinks the value
right,
is, what they're willing to pull their checkbook out for.
Right. And they should also be familiar with what a lot of brokers know is the first offer rule. If you price it at $350 and the first offer comes in at $335, you might counter them, but that's probably going to be your best buyer. The first one right off the bat. Unless you get 10 the same day, that's different, you know. But typically the first offer is your buyer, you know, and you have to, and if you blow that by overpricing it, and then 5 or 10 people go look at it and go, this is way overpriced. You blew it. I mean, you could quickly drop it, but most people who looked at it in the first time already have a bad attitude about it and aren't likely going to go see it again or make an offer because you dropped it $5,000. Unless you're in a very desirable neighborhood where there's just nothing else for sale. Then you can get away with it. That would be the exception. I'm a believer at pricing it right for a quick sale, and basing that off everything in the beginning. So when you figured I'm going to make $35,000 based on that price, you know, why get greedy and go, well, maybe I can make $45,000? Because you could blow it by overpricing it for the neighborhood. And there's always the risk it won't appraise, too. Especially if the high end of the neighborhood's $300,000 and you're going, well, I can get $335,000 because it's just so much nicer than everything else. Appraiser might not agree with you, even though someone's willing to pay it.
Well, it is certainly a sticky wicket.
Yes,
I'm of this school of thought price it reasonable, but then you have the owner, you know,
right,
standing there, you know, waving their hands and saying, but this, and
right,
you're
well,
saying
your job, as the listing agent is to be the deliverer of reality.
Yeah, like, didn't they get beheaded or something? Like, isn't that... the house next door to it sold for... sold $25,000 above the list price, and granted it was perfect everywhere inside, only one owner in 40 years, and, you know, a totally different kind of house, it's a sticky wicket.
Yes, it is. I agree. That's a good expression, sticky wicket. Okay. By the way, in terms of topic, we always want to hear feedback from you guys about what you're trying to, topics you want to hear. So definitely let us know if there's a topic we haven't covered or haven't covered in a while. Interested to hear your feedback. And in terms of the recordings of the events, I think we're a few weeks behind. And I said, as soon as I get a new IT guy, we'll have that rolling.
I think we're actually maybe a week or two is all, Bill. I just checked this morning. So I think we're okay. We'll see about today. Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Do we have any upcoming events?
Oh, yes. We have, we're doing a partnering workshop May 6th, was it?
the May 6th, yes, at the, I think it's the Embassy, is it the Embassy Suites off of Havana and I-70?
Yes, Havana and I-70. Just let us know. Please don't just show up because we have to limited number of seats, so just let us know if you definitely want to attend.
But if you do tell us, please show up.
Yes.
Because we have to account for numbers and things like that. And if you just go ahead and email me, this is Frank, either fpulley@bronchick.com or frank@bronchick.com, I'll get your name on the list.
Great.
Oh, Bill.
Yes.
You could talk about your new book.
My new book. Yes, I can. Thank you. It is called The Business of Flipping Homes. It's partially based on my old Flipping Properties book, but a little more in-depth and a little more of a business-like approach. I was trying to get people who would buy it who were thinking of starting a business and said, oh, I never thought of real estate as a business. But it's also for people who were in, you know, real estate and then how to treat it more like a business. So you can find it on Amazon. A review is always appreciated, if it's a good one. Okay. Well, thanks, everyone, for joining. Good call. Great questions. And if you think of anything, follow up after the call that you forgot to ask, just drop us an email.
Thank you for listening to Bill Bronchick's Real Estate Investing Podcast. For more information and free articles and videos, visit his website at www.legalwiz.com.